When 10 years ago I wintered on the subantarctic island that Captain Cook, on his search for the undiscovered southern continent called Desolation Island, I marvelled not only at the skill and guts that took him into these wild oceans, but at the way he was mapping as he went, his painstaking but incomplete maps the first draft of geography. I have one in front of me now, but I knew nothing then of the man who followed Cook 3 decades later and made, it may be claimed, the first proper map of Australia. My guest today, nominating that man as his great life, seems on first sight such a contrast. Admired for his skill in business, his instinct for retailing, and the fine cut of his suit, he's best known now as the head of Marks & Spencer, whose fortunes he helped reverse after joining in 2004. The Sunday Telegraph described him as having the smile of a kitten strangler, but looking at you now, Sir Stuart, I don't recognise that across the table today. More kitten, really, than kitten strangler, but you don't turn round the fortunes of a once ailing retail giant without claws. Sir Stuart Rose, name your choice.
My choice for your programme today is Matthew Flinders, the man, as you say, who did actually define the shape of Australia as we know it today.
Why Matthew Flinders?
Well, I've always been interested in explorers who've, if you like, done things which are spectacularly difficult looked over time. And if you think about going back 200 years to what Matthew Flinders did, barely at the age of 20, took himself off, perhaps not knowing if he was ever going to come back again, and with a very small crew in a very small boat over a series of journeys, he set himself the task of not only making a man of himself, but actually doing something which he considered to be good for society, good for humanity, and would leave a mark, his mark on life, and he did that extremely well.
We'll discover in due course just how jaw-juttingly determined a man and an adventurer Matthew Flinders was. Can I ask you, Stuart, straight off, do you see something of yourself in this gritty, strategic-thinking personality?
No, not obviously. If you ask me the question and I think about it, I suppose that we all are faced with challenges in life and we all want to succeed. I suppose I wouldn't flatter myself to compare myself with Matthew Flinders, but I suppose I am a bit bloody-minded, I am a bit difficult, and I have tried to make something of my life, but nothing on the scale of what Matthew Flinders achieved.
The discovery of Australia was once described as the last sea thing dredged by sailor time from space. That extraordinary event was not the work of our great life today, but what Matthew Flinders did do in His Majesty's ship, the Investigator, was to map this discovery properly. Before we hear from our expert witness about what an undertaking this was, as Stuart has suggested, I'd just like you to hear from a Radio 4 play which captures something of the wonder Flinders must have felt, beginning with the exploration of the Great Barrier Reef. The dramatised voices you hear are of both Flinders and his wife, Anne.
All manner of coral, witch sheaves, mushrooms, staghorns, cabbage leaves and a variety of other forms, glowing under the water with vivid tints of every shade betwixt green, purple, brown and white.
The strange beasts and the native peoples, paintings on the walls of caves.
Made with charcoal and something like red paint upon the white ground of the rock. These drawings represented porpoises, turtles, kangaroos, and a human hand.
And miles of previously uncharted coast, bays and capes and islands, the whole of Australia, all marked and recorded by Matthew.
Glasshouse Bay, Cape Catastrophe, Blue Mud Bay, Kangaroo Island, Lucky Bay, Memory Cove.
So, this is now his record. A voyage to Terra Australis. This is how he will be remembered.
Well, with me here remembering Matthew Flinders is a man who knows about the sea and the problems of making maps 3 centuries ago. The head of research at the National Maritime Museum, Dr. Nigel Rigby, co-author of Pioneers of the Pacific, Voyages of Exploration, 1787 to 1810. We're talking here, aren't we, Nigel, about a place about as unknown and dangerous to reach in its time as the moon in ours. The quest to capture information about the newly discovered Terra Australis really is comparable to the exploration of outer space.
Yes, it was a massive undertaking. Australia was months away from Britain by sea, and the size of Australia is just mind-boggling. And the task of actually charting that was phenomenal.
Enormous physical dangers, too. I think he lost a cutter, was it, with eight men?
Yes.
At one point?
Yes, I think fairly early on the south coast, they were out, I think, surveying, and the boat was about 3 miles back away from the investigator. They saw it and sighted it. There was a heavy riptide. The boat disappeared, and they never found anything apart from an upturned boat, but no bodies. They were presumed all eaten by the sharks, of which there were plenty.
But one of the things about that, I think, is it draws out another aspect of Flinders, which was his humanity. I think he was a very humane man, and I think he felt that loss personally. And he named islands around the area after the eight crew that were killed.
Is it true that only two of those eight were actually able to swim anyway?
Yes, but that wasn't unusual. Very few seamen actually knew how to swim. I suppose they worked on the assumption that it was probably better to die quickly.
Yes. And there were problems with Aborigines?
The meetings with Aborigines were varied, actually. It was a two-sided thing. Some were very interested in seeing the seamen, and others weren't. Others were scared. Others were quite aggressive. So it varied a lot. But he actually took an Aborigine with him.
Bongaree, was
Bongaree, he? Yes, who had sailed with Flinders in Tom Thumb.
Did Bongaree speak English?
Well, actually, I don't know the answer to that, but he must have done, or spoke some rudimentary English, because he was actually, in some cases, the interpreter, particularly on the southern part of Australia, with the Aborigines who spoke the same language as himself. But actually, he was also the person who was often sent ashore to have first contact with the natives. And I was interested to see that what he used to do is to take his clothes off, swim ashore naked, unarmed, and try and make contact. But he wasn't always successful.
No. There were one or two times when he got the wrong sort of response.
That's when you don't want to be naked and unarmed.
That's exactly, yes.
Do we know what Flinders looked like?
Yes, he wasn't a big man.
I can't picture him.
About 5'7", which is just a little bit taller than Nelson, which was about average at the time, although he considered himself quite short. In fact, once had the railing around the investigator taken down a bit because he actually couldn't see over it to do the surveying at some stage.
I imagine him as a very energetic man, full of vitality, energy, because you have to realise when these people go on these journeys, he's not only responsible for the ship, but they have to do everything. They have to be completely self-sufficient. They have to plan for everything. They have to be able to adapt. They have to be able to improvise. And certainly he had his full fair share of decisions to make on that basis.
He was a very driven man. I think there's no doubt about that.
When and where was Flinders born?
He was born in 1774 in Donnington, Lincolnshire, and his father was an apothecary or surgeon. And he went to school, the local grammar school, but his father plucked him out of school at the age of 14 or 15, and put him to work training to be an apothecary himself. But Flinders didn't like that idea, and apparently he read Robinson Crusoe as a boy and was fired by that.
But before he became a sort of hydrographer and explorer, he was actually an active midshipman. He fought in the Battle of the 1st of June, the famous action of Admiral Howe. So he had the seagoing action as well.
Is that the Admiral Howe after whom Lord Howe Island off Australia is named, Nigel?
That's the one, yes.
Same man.
And Flinders, of course, he was on the Bellerophon, and his admiral was Pasley, the man who had been his patron and given him his first job at sea. And he saw Pasley lose his leg to a cannonball during the battle.
He thought he'd seen enough of battle by then.
It was 3 days, I think, the battle lasted. I mean, it was the glorious 1st of June, but it could have been the glorious 31st of May. And the Royal Navy was, in the Napoleonic Wars, was the biggest employer in Britain.
Do you imagine, Stuart Rose, that you could have had a completely different career if a turn of events had taken you off in another direction? How did you end up doing what you're doing now?
Actually, I did have ambitions to join the Navy when I was young, and my father absolutely forbade it, so I didn't. And how did I end up doing what I'm doing now? Well, in truth, I couldn't get anybody else to employ me, and I wrote to 25 companies, and the first company to offer me a reply and an interview and a second interview and a third interview and subsequently a job was Marks & Spencer, so to them I owe great debt.
Matthew Flinders wrote a pretty memorable letter in search of his, and we'll come to it in just a moment, but he wrote it to Joseph Banks, who was head of the Royal Society, had a keen interest in Australia. Why had Matthew Flinders developed an interest in Australia at this time?
Well, after the Battle of the Glorious 1st of June, when he was, you know, he'd lost his patron, effectively. He was posted on the Reliance, which was sent out to Australia, and he stayed there several years. And it was during that time that he did those amazing voyages in a progression of small boats, the smallest of which was about 8 feet long.
I mean, Tom Thumb.
The Tom Thumb, yes. I mean, frankly, I hesitate to row across the Medway in my sort of 8 foot dinghy, and he rowed miles down the coast of Australia.
Yes, and the Pacific in New
yeah,
South Wales.
Absolutely.
Yes,
an
ocean.
Dangerous place,
yeah.
and faced a lot of dangers doing it, he and George Bass together. And it brought him to the attention of Hunter, who was the governor at the time, and also of Banks. And Hunter himself wrote to Banks with the idea for an exploration of Australia, which was actually turned down, but it was reinvented by Flinders later on.
And Flinders wrote to Banks, and it's basically a give-us-a-job kind of letter, and it's an absolutely extraordinary letter, which I think reading it just gives you an indication of the character of the whole man. And I might ask you, Stuart Rose, if you'd read the letter out.
I have too much ambition to rest in the unnoticed middle order of mankind. Since neither birth nor fortune have favoured me, my actions shall speak to the world. In the regular service of the Navy, there are too many competitors for fame. I have therefore chosen a branch which, though less rewarded by rank and fortune, is yet little less in celebrity. In this the candidates are fewer, and in this, if adverse fortune does not oppose me, I will succeed.
There's a curious alloy there of passion with cold calculation, isn't there? I mean, he's looked at where, in a maritime job, he's least likely to run into serious competition in a cold sort of way, and yet, in a terrifically passionate way, he wants to go.
Absolutely. I think you talk about coldness and you talk about calculation. I think for me, the one of the great telling things about him was the fact that he was torn about the prospect of marrying Anne Chappell. He eventually decided he would marry Anne Chappell. He came up with a plan to take her to Australia without their lordship's permission, which was pretty unusual in those days. Banks objected to this, and effectively he dumped his wife at home and didn't see her again for 9 years.
And do you think he actually wanted to escape the decision whether to marry or not, and that's why he wanted to go to Australia, or...?
No, I think in truth, that as he described it, I think that he realised that if he was to look after her in the manner that he wanted and he was to be successful, I think absolutely we would probably describe him today as being slightly selfish. He did want to succeed, but he also wanted to make sure that if he did marry or when he married, that he would look after his wife in the proper manner, and he couldn't do that unless he'd brought some fame and fortune upon himself and obviously some cash.
And what was Banks able to do for him, Nigel?
Well, Banks really fulfilled the role of the patron that he'd lost with Pasley. Banks had been the naturalist on Cook's first voyage, and he, when he got back, he became gradually, you know, the centre of exploration, especially after Cook died. There were a number of seamen who followed Cook, you know, who had been trained by Cook, and they all looked to Banks for the sort of patronage and preferment that they lost with Cook. And so Banks played that hugely important role. Without Banks, the voyage itself would never have happened. Flinders wrote to Banks with the idea for a joint expedition, something which would survey the coast of Australia. That was the buy-in for the Admiralty, if you like, but also to study the natural history of the land, and that was the buy-in for Banks, because he was a passionate botanist.
Where did the money come from?
It came from the Admiralty, largely. They funded the voyage, but Banks also managed to get money out of the East India Company. He got money for the officers, for their meals and things, table money, it was called. Banks himself subsidised the voyage. You know, he sort of donated a library and things like that to Flinders. But it was primarily from the Admiralty.
Did Australia matter a lot to the British government at that time?
Well, that's an interesting question, and there's a bit of a debate about that, I think. A number of academics think that this was all part of a very clear strategy to develop, if you like, an empire of the South, you know, based on Australia. And others would argue that actually the Admiralty had very little interest in Australia at all. And years after the voyage, when the naturalist Brown and the botanical artist Ferdinand Bauer came back to England, they arrived at the Admiralty in London in November 1805, and of course the Admiralty was kind of preoccupied at the time with the Battle of Trafalgar and the death of Nelson, and they were never seen.
We'll come to that in a while, but this then is the way things have gone. He's written to Banks. He's, so to speak, got his commission to go out on the mapping expedition. He's initially wanted his wife Anne to come with him. In fact, he writes this to her: "It will be much better to keep this matter entirely secret. I do not exactly know how my great friends might like it." His great friends found out. Anne's banned. Off he goes without Anne. And the trip, which began in 1801, almost immediately meets disaster when the ship runs aground off the south coast. Turns out that the investigator had a leak, taking on 5 inches of water an hour in high seas. Can we even start to imagine what hardships those explorers had to face, Stuart?
No, I mean, it's quite extraordinary. And I mean, I read the pages of this book again and again, and you just ask yourself the huge responsibility that this man carried, the responsibility for not only for carrying out His Majesty's commission, but also for the lives of these people, for the provisioning of these people, for the health of these people, for their navigation. And the navigation in those days was pretty rudimentary. And yet you say he laid a course. And sure enough, he turned up at where he wanted to get to 30, 40 days later, having pumped 5 inches of water an hour out of the boat. It was quite extraordinary. I mean, it really was. I'd be terrified.
You're listening to Great Lives. Stuart Rose has chosen Matthew Flinders, mapmaker of Australia. And also here helping us is Nigel Rigby of the National Maritime Museum. Nigel, Flinders wrote that his ambition was to make such a minute investigation of this extensive and very interesting country that no person shall have occasion to come after me to make further discoveries. Before we discuss whether he achieved this aim, tell us how, technically, he hoped to chart this massive continent.
The main tool was something called a running survey. The idea was that you steered a steady course along the coast, taking bearings of objects along the coast, from which you were able to determine their distance from you. Flinders would spend a whole day doing that, and then heave to overnight and start again from where he'd left off. And so you could build up a very accurate picture of the coastline.
I've got in front of me the map that he finally produced of the whole of Australia, produced in exactly the manner that you've described, bit by bit, taking bearings as you go. And the extraordinary thing is, it looks exactly like Australia. I mean, he's got it completely right. I can't give people a map of how to get from the nearest village to my house without everything becoming completely distorted. It really works.
It does work, yes, although it's a long process. And, of course, what Flinders would do as well was he would stop periodically to give the botanists, the naturalists, a chance to explore. The problem with doing a running survey was that you actually had to understand the work of the currents and the wind, and you had to know exactly what your speed was over the ground. It was a very complicated process.
And you had to deal with human frailty, because I was always amused to read from time to time, but it was actually quite frequently that somebody would forget to wind the chronometers. So they'd have to reset all the chronometers and rebase the timing, which must have been very difficult.
Yes, and it was generally his brother Samuel who forgot to wind up the chronometers, and it certainly caused problems to their relationship.
They'd reached Sydney 295 days after leaving Spithead. What did Sydney look like at this time, Stuart? Have you any idea of the sort of place?
It was basically a settlement. It had been settled about 20 or 30 years earlier. It was already then, I believe, a penal colony, and it was literally surviving because there was no indigenous growth of fruit and vegetables, so people had to take pretty well all the provisions with them. People were scraping a living. The military were there maintaining some sort of control, and I think they were living very much from hand to mouth, waiting for the next boat to come from England with supplies and often not knowing when it would arrive. So I think it was pretty difficult early period.
And what would the attitude of the colonists have been to someone who'd come to make maps? They'd think it was a bit of a Ponzi thing to do, wouldn't they? Was he well received?
He was well received, if only for the sort of novelty, I think. It was clearly very important indeed, if you're wanting to develop a colony, to know how to get there without sinking, and also to know something of what grows in the interior. You know, it was, if you like, economic botany that the botanists were sort of carrying out. They were really sort of interested in all sorts of produce which, you know, could help support life.
Funny question here, but why had it taken them so long for someone like him to come and do what one might have thought was quite essential groundwork?
Well, bits of it had been charted. Cook had done a bit of the East Coast, although fairly superficially. It was a running survey, and he was quite a long distance offshore when he was doing it. And the French explorer, D'Entrecasteaux, did quite a lot of the South Coast. But it was because, if you're not really going to an area, you don't really have the need to chart it. And there was no real desire at that time. It wasn't until the colony opened, really, in 88. That's when it started to become vital.
And the East India Company were looking to see if they could extend trade routes from the north, weren't they? I think the Torres Strait was quite an important thing to get sorted out.
How did he sort out the Torres Strait?
He sailed through it. But he did it in a way which was much quicker than the voyage that had been made by Cook. And the other big question, which was begging at the time, which he effectively answered, was Australia actually one landmass or was it two landmasses? And there was quite, I think, Nigel, for some time, people thought it was broken in the middle.
Well, no one really knew, but it was a theory, because, of course, at the top of Australia, you've got that great sort of chunk, which is the Gulf of Carpentaria, which could have been the beginnings of a gulf going down. So, yes, there was a theory, and he did disprove that very quickly, I think.
He had a rather depressive botanist on board called Robert Brown, who wrote to Joseph Banks, "Our acquisitions in botany are much fewer than I'd hoped for in a country so completely new. In zoology, we've not done much. Our additions in ornithology are exceedingly few. Mineralogy continues as barren a field as ever." Did the expedition at some point seem to be rather running into the marine equivalent of the sand, do you think?
I don't know, Nigel. Perhaps you've got a view on this, but I think I get the impression, my view is that Flinders was into mapping.
Yeah.
And they were probably a bit frustrated that they didn't have more time in the various places to do more investigations. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
Yes. And in fact, Brown was definitely a glass half empty man. There's no doubt about that. He sort of rather reminds me of that John Laurie character.
And was Flinders a glass half full man? Was he an optimistic?
Definitely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
How important is optimism in any great endeavours to you?
Absolutely vital. You can imagine those days when he himself must have been uncertain about what they were doing, whether they were going to get there, whether they will achieve their task, and a huge responsibility. And I think there is somewhere mentioned in the book that I read about the loneliness of leadership. The fact that you cannot go and talk to your fellow crew members about your worries, you have to carry that on your shoulders. You have to remember, this is a man of 25. Matthew Flinders never let his crew down.
He certainly didn't. And even when they were wanting to give up, he was wanting to sort of carry on with the survey when the investigator was really waterlogged. He was pushing them on. He was still sort of wanting
to... You must know the feelings.
Well, he had the row with his surgeon, didn't he?
Yes, he had quite a lot of rows with his surgeon, I think.
You must know the feeling of trying to keep people going when faint hearts are saying turn back and mutinies all around.
There are many examples in life, absolutely. I've had a bit of that myself.
You were talking about his return home, not having realised that the Napoleonic Wars were going on. So he's completed his map-making expedition, Nigel, and he sets out back for Britain, completely ignorant about the state of world history.
He set off back home in convoy with a couple of other ships, and they were wrecked on somewhere called Wreck Reef, and he had to then sail back. He took a ship's boat and sailed back to Sydney and picked them up, the rest of the crew, and he made his way to Mauritius. He wasn't planning to call on Mauritius, but it was taking on even more water than the investigator had been, and very dangerous.
Stuart, how long was he on Mauritius?
A lot longer than he expected to be. 6 years, 5 months and 27 days.
Because
extraordinary.
Because Mauritius was a French colony and France was at war with Britain.
It was, although...
And he hadn't realised.
Well, the war had stopped and then it started again. Of course, he was in the bit and he didn't know whether it had stopped or started. Hmm.
And it was there that he was imprisoned by the governor.
Here is his letter to the French governor. Would you mind reading it for me, Stuart Rose?
"Now, sir, I would beg to ask you whether it becomes the French nation to stop the progress of such a voyage, and of which the whole maritime world are received the benefit. I sought protection and assistance in your port, and I have found a prison."
He must have felt completely trapped.
Well, I think he was probably ill. I mean, he didn't have many more years to live. He died at 40, barely 40. And, you know, if you have been doing the sort of journeys that he'd been doing, often probably in very hot conditions without enough fluid and liquid, with not enough citrus fruits and whatever else. He did have scorbutic sores. And I think that, on top of the sort of mental anguish of being stuck in a place for 3, 4, 5 years, would have taken quite a toll on him mentally.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would agree with that, only adding, I think, that he was still suffering from the treatment he'd received for VD and they treated it with mercury, which certainly didn't help. So he was in a bad way, I think, yeah.
He returned to Portsmouth in October 1810, finally reunited with his wife. I think she'd forgotten what sort of a person he was by then.
So a very forgiving woman she must have been.
Have you ever envied, as I have, Stuart, the men and women of ancient days who, for all their courage and strength and skill and all the rest, they were blessed in one way, that there were big things to discover, easily recognisable challenges to take on, and thought in our day that there aren't those big, simple tasks, those undiscovered continents to be discovered?
Yes, I think that's probably quite an interesting way of looking at it, although I also probably think that the hills that they climbed in relative terms were massively bigger than the hills we climb today because of all the aids and assistance we've got. I mean, they were the true pioneers. You look at some of the things that were achieved by people with, you know, in the most terrible conditions with the most rudimentary equipment. It is amazing. And this map for me of Australia, you know, if you take a Google map from, I don't know, 20,000 miles up of Australia and look at it today, it's pretty good.
But the irony, I think, with Flinders was that everybody who came after Cook thought that Cook had done it all, and all they were doing was filling in the bits around the edges. Mm. So actually, they felt probably then in the way that you're describing it, that, you know, with us today, Matthew.
Would he have cared about his legacy, Stuart? Would he have cared whether we credited Cook or him? What sort of a man would you expect
to meet?
Well,
I think Nigel said it. First of all, he was a very generous man. I mean, he gave absolute credit. And there was a kind of convention at the time that if you had discovered something or somebody else had, that you punctiliously recorded on the map which was yours and which was somebody else's discovery. And he got quite upset at one point when the French published a document, Baudin's Journeys, I think it was,
right,
claiming that he had discovered bits that Flinders had discovered. So it was a play fair type attitude. But he was very generous in recognising what others had done. But equally, I think he was absolutely wanted to leave a mark. And I think the nice thing was that when he knew he was dying, he actually did apparently see the final proofs of the book, which was quite nice, before he popped his clogs.
Matthew Flinders died in 1814 after a huge battle with his ailments. And I'd just like to ask you, Stuart Rose, to read out, as we finish, the full title, the long title, of your hero's book.
A Voyage to Terra Australis, undertaken for the purpose of completing the discovery of that vast country and prosecuted in the years 1801, 1802 and 1803 in His Majesty's ship the Investigator and subsequently in the armed vessel Porpoise and Cumberland schooner, with an account of the shipwreck of Porpoise, arrival of the Cumberland at Mauritius and imprisonment of the commander during 6.5 years on that island.
You've been listening to Great Lives, where my guest, Sir Stuart Rose, has chosen Matthew Flinders, and our expert witness has been Nigel Rigby. Goodbye.